all spending has to be looked at. The size of the budget gap is just demands that everything has to be part of the conversation.
Turning up the heat on the state budget. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, December 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Kodiak bison may wander, but that doesn't mean they can be hunted.
The fact that the buffalo do walk on and off the leases doesn't make them feral whatsoever. They're still privately owned livestock.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $10 million to nonprofit organizations benefiting everything from Alaska's youth to the arts to health care. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive and well in Alaska. So come on, Alaska, warm your heart by sharing your PFD. Pick, click, give. This message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil.
An Anchor Point girl is in stable condition after losing both of her legs in a traffic accident on Christmas Day. That's according to a post by her aunt, Emily Hawkinson, on a GoFundMe account she started to raise money for the girl's medical treatment. 11-year-old Angelica Hawkinson and her pregnant mother, 29-year-old Matheny Christine Satterwhite, were driving on Sterling Highway on Thursday when their truck broke down. The Peninsula Clarion reported Nathan Sargent was helping the family jump the truck when Anchor Point resident Larry Pyatt slid into them with his vehicle. Both Sargent and Pyatt suffered minor injuries, and Satterwhite was thrown into a ditch. Hawkinson was pinned between two of the vehicles, resulting in multiple spinal fractures and severe trauma to her legs. The mother and daughter were flown to Anchorage for emergency treatment. Satterwhite and her unborn child survived. Both of Hawkinson's legs were amputated above the knee. By this afternoon, the GoFundMe campaign had raised more than $41,000 from about 600 donors, including local residents, peninsula businesses, and area emergency services. Angelica Hawkinson is a sixth grader at Chapman Elementary School in Anchor Point. A Sunday house fire in Koyuk has claimed the life of one woman and seriously injured one other person. KNOM's Matthew Smith has the story.
Alaska State Troopers received the call around 2 o'clock Sunday afternoon. Trooper spokesperson Beth Ibsen says, quote, "The call was a fire and that a person was found dead. The fire was extinguished by the time troopers arrived on the scene in Koyuk, but not before the smoke and flames took the life of 82-year-old Elder Ethel Adams. Another man in the home, 41-year-old Dale Adams, was seriously burned in the fire. Dale's sister, Bede Prentice, says people ice fishing nearby heard an explosion before seeing the thick black smoke fill the air.
And they heard a couple big pop noises from our home, so we're assuming the kerosene heater blew up.
Bede thinks her brother Dale was burned trying to turn off that heater and save the woman who raised them both as her own children from the growing flames.
I know my brother was trying to turn it out because he has burns on his hands and arms and around his face. He got burnt too.
Bede says her brother was medevaced to Anchorage last night. He got out of surgery this afternoon. She says he remains in the intensive care unit at the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage. One other person was in the home during the fire, a young boy, and troopers say he escaped the flames unharmed and is now staying with relatives in Koyuk. Family members have been notified of the blaze and are in Anchorage with Dale Adams. The remains of Ethel Adams will be sent to the state medical examiner to determine the exact cause of death. The source of the fire is still under investigation. Troopers say a deputy fire marshal traveled to Koyuk today to determine the ultimate cause of the fire. In Nome, I'm Matthew Smith.
Anchorage police say a woman died when she was struck by a vehicle as she walked on a rural municipal street. Police say 59-year-old Dolores Green was struck on O'Malley Road near its upper end in the city's hillside area. The accident occurred just after 5:30 p.m. yesterday near O'Malley Road's intersection with Main Tree Drive. Police say Green may have been crossing O'Malley when she was struck by a sedan driving west. The driver stopped and cooperated with police. Friday, the Alaska Supreme Court overturned an Alaska Department of Fish and Game regulation from 2007 that declared domesticated livestock, specifically Kodiak's bison herds, were feral if they stayed outside of their designated state grazing lease areas for too long. As feral animals, they would be fair game and could be hunted like any other wild animal, subject to fish and game regulations. KMXT's Jay Barrett has more.
Kodiak rancher Charles Dorman appealed the Board of Game's 2007 regulation to State Superior Court in 2010 after a two-plus-year grace period to round up all his bison and getting a notice that a winter hunt was being planned on his wayward animals. Dorman maintained that domestic livestock cannot be considered feral if their owners are known. With only two herds separated by miles of mountains on the island, Dorman argued everyone knew whose bison were whose, but Superior Court Judge Sen K. Tan ruled against Dorman and awarded the state over $8,700 in legal fees. On Friday, the Supreme Court overturned Judge Tan's decision and Fish and Game's rule, saying the state's regulatory definition of feral was arbitrary and conflicted with its use elsewhere in the state hunting regulations.
It's good that the Supreme Court did confirm that they are open grazing leases.
Frank Bishop is a bison rancher in Kodiak whose herd also grazes on state land, not far from where the Dorman lease is.
The fact that the buffalo do walk on and off the leases doesn't make them feral whatsoever. They're still privately owned livestock. And the people of Kodiak should know that. But and no matter where the buffalo are, they're either owned by the Burdens, myself, or the Dorman family.
Larry Van Dale is the South Central Region's supervisor for Fish and Game. He was quick to point out that the Supreme Court ruling does not relieve leaseholders from respecting the boundaries of the state land their livestock grazes on.
It does not mean that anybody can run their domestic livestock anywhere they want in the state. I mean, there's still state grazing leases, and the Department of Natural Resources still has jurisdiction on where those leases' boundaries are. And I can't speak for them, but I believe they also have fines for people that go off lease and use resources that they're not responsible for. So it's not like where the buffalo roam and they can go anywhere in Alaska. It means that this one piece of the department's responsibility is no longer valid.
Bishop said bison are well known for their wandering ways, and he tries hard to be a good neighbor and thinks other ranchers do too.
I don't want to destroy somebody's property, private property or anything else. That's why I make a concentrated effort to go get them and put them back on the lease if they wander off.
Though larger wood bison are native to Alaska and were recently reintroduced to the interior, Kodiak Island's plains bison were brought here 50 or so years ago as a hardier alternative to cattle, which ranchers were losing in large numbers to bears. Because they are bigger, smarter, and tend to herd up closer together, Van Dale said bison were better able to fend off the always opportunistic Bruins, but their size and strength also allowed them to break through barbed wire fences much easier than cattle, which was the genesis of the wandering bison issue. Bison owner Charles Dorman did not live to see his victory in the Alaska Supreme Court. He died 5 months ago at the age of 78. In Kodiak, I'm Jay Barrett.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, veterinarians bring a free spaying and neutering clinic to the YK Delta.
Neutering dogs, fixing them up, it's going to help us a lot. And I'm glad they're doing that. For the safety of our kids, for the safety of our elders.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Alaska's new director of the Office of Management and Budget has a big job ahead of her. Governor Walker announced on Friday that he wants to put a hold on six large projects until they can be thoroughly reviewed. The projects are the Small Diameter Gas Pipeline, the Kodiak Rocket Launch Complex, the Kanikarm Bridge, the Susitna-Watana Hydroelectric Dam, the Juneau Access Road, and the Ambler Road. OMB's new director, Pat Pitney, says she wants Alaskans to be involved in the conversation on how to trim the state budget as the price of oil falls. Pitney is a former vice chancellor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She says budget cuts are necessary, but the Walker administration wants to be strategic about where they happen.
I think it's challenging fiscally, but the opportunity for the state to engage the public, the legislature, in lasting solutions is optimal given the situation. And so having the opportunity to be in those conversations is good.
The state may have to draw nearly $7 billion from savings to pay for the budget that passed this year, along with the new one that will be drafted this year. That's a big chunk of the state's savings. How much can you limit dipping into those reserves?
Well, any limit comes with either a change in how we do services or a reduction in services. We're going to focus on how we deliver services and get as streamlined as possible, limiting services that are acceptable to limit based on, you know, having a strong state. So I would say that there's going to be a draw on savings, but the administration is committed to being as constrained as possible.
And realistically, what can the state do to trim the budget?
You reduce spending in agencies and other entities, and that it really does come down to state jobs. And in many respects, there's also capital projects that you could either stop doing some that you're doing now, or scale down on the size of them. But all spending has to be looked at. The size of the budget gap just demands that everything has to be part of the conversation of how can we reduce our spending.
The state has been through periods of low oil prices before. Are there lessons you take from those days, or is this fundamentally just a different time that we're seeing and a different convergence of things?
It's a different time in that we've come off of 10 years of, you know, savings. So that helps. We have savings in the bank. We're paying things that we didn't pay for during the 90s, you know, the retirement fund, maintenance. So I think two fundamental differences. One, we've come off several years of really good revenue from oil. But number two, our fiscal assets for the state are tremendously better than in the past when revenues were down.
Governor Walker campaigned heavily on construction of a gas line, and he has in the past suggested that the state take a larger ownership role in such a project. Even with a minority stake, the expected price tag for the state is in the billions. How does the state move forward on such an expensive project when we're looking at a $7 billion shortfall over this year and next?
It's an investment. If you want to see our dependence on strictly one commodity of oil be balanced with another natural resource, this is one of the possible investments. It also can help the energy needs for the state. And right now we don't have necessarily the energy security or basic affordable energy throughout the state. And so that's a solution for that. So it really becomes an investment for a better future.
if you were going to look at this and say, okay, here's what we have coming in, here's what we have proposed to spend, what would you say that we would need to do to make this happen within that five-year window so that we don't run out of reserves? What kind of percentages would we really have to carve out of the budget in the next 3 years, say, to make this realistic? What are lawmakers going to really be looking at for being able to make this happen?
Well, I'm not going to put a percentage basis on it. I think the first thing you want to do is put reductions in place, but put them in place where they're smart. You can, you know, cut across the board and then all functions don't work. Or you can reduce in a way that makes people work together to find a better way to do the business. And we would really like to have the reductions focused first on, we know we have to reduce our spending, but can we service these functions in a better way? Focusing on continuing the programs and services, but reducing administrative infrastructure, or looking where items are similar, could we combine those to get the most out of the service delivery? So reducing first, and if oil prices stay low, then it's a statewide conversation on what services do you really want and is there a different way to pay for them?
Pat Pitney is director of the Office of Management and Budget. A high wind warning in place for Turnagain Arm and higher elevations is expected to last until 9 a.m. Tuesday, with the National Weather Service warning of projectile debris and hazardous driving conditions in the warning area. The Weather Service forecasts southeast winds of 50 to 65 miles per hour with gusts to 80 miles an hour. The winds will increase to warning levels by early evening before diminishing by mid-morning tomorrow. The Weather Service is urging people to secure loose objects that could be blown around or damaged by the wind. The survivor of the December 6th avalanche at Rainbow Ridge returned to the site last week to recover the bodies of his friend and his dog. Michael Hopper says he had to go because Alaska State Troopers had ruled out a recovery mission until the danger of the avalanche in the area subsided. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, that could have taken months.
Michael Hopper says he and a companion set out a week ago intending to scout out the area where his friend Eric Peterson and his dog Rowdy were buried to determine whether a recovery mission was even possible. Both Hopper and his companion, Dan Perpich, are experienced backcountry skiers, so he says they knew it was risky to return to the site. He says they proceeded cautiously during the 2.5-hour trek to Rainbow Ridge from the Richardson Highway, about 10 miles north of Isabel Pass.
It was still unnerving, I have to admit.
Hopper says once they got back to the debris field where his friends were buried and surveyed the area, they decided a recovery was doable. They mapped out a safe route away from avalanche-prone areas and started digging. Hopper says Perpich was the ideal companion for the mission because he's a veteran who's been through courses at the Army's Northern Warfare Training Center out of the Black Rapids training site.
You see plenty of training in avalanche awareness and also in rescue and recoveries of all sorts. So he was a handy guy to have along.
Hopper and Perpich worked for two full days to remove the bodies and bring them out. He says it was a relief for both him and Peterson's family to recover the bodies because he'd been nagged by the thought of leaving his friends behind until the danger of avalanche subsided. That could have taken weeks, even months.
We felt it was important, I think, to the family to know their son was off the mountain. So there was a sense of, you know, rightness about that. And it was also, it was good for me to find my dog as well.
Hopper says he also found comfort in how he found his dog.
Probably the only light in this dark mission was when we found Rowdy. He was curled up right up against Eric's back, and he had his right paw on Eric's shoulder. And it looked very, very much like he just curled up next to Eric and went to sleep.
Hopper speaks quietly now and stops to clear his throat every couple of minutes. He says that's because he re-injured his lungs during the recovery mission after damaging them when he was buried in the avalanche. He managed to dig himself out that time, but not before breathing in a lot of snow and accumulating fluid in his lungs.
I'm under strict orders now not to play outside for a month.
Hopper told Alaska State Troopers last Tuesday that he'd recovered Peterson's body. He turned it over to troopers, who in turn transported it to the state medical examiner's office. Hopper says Peterson's remains will be returned to his family in Rhode Island for interment. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
Alaska Pacific University is proud to announce the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. Deadline to apply is March 1, 2015. Alaska Pacific University, a private nonprofit committed to personalized experiential learning that incorporates Alaska as its principal classroom. More at 1-800-252-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
State prosecutors have dropped their case against two Unalaskans accused of running a major drug operation out of their home and business. Now it's up to a federal court to determine the outcome. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal has more.
Tim Nguyen and Tu McConnell were arrested in May after police tied an alleged heroin sale back to their convenience store. When officers searched the Dutch Harbor Asia shop and the couple's home, they found one of the biggest caches of methamphetamine and cocaine they had ever seen in Unalaska, with a street value of more than $500,000. A grand jury indicted Nguyen and McConnell on multiple felony counts this summer, paving the way for a trial in state court. But Assistant District Attorney Laura Dulick signed an order dismissing all charges against the defendants, quote, without prejudice. Dulick did not respond to repeated requests for comment. According to a press release from the Alaska Attorney General's office, the decision came after talking with federal prosecutors. Nguyen has also been indicted in U.S. District Court, and federal sentences are tough when it comes to distributing drugs and possessing firearms. But the case against Nguyen is based on evidence collected by Unalaska police, and defense attorneys have been fighting to get most of that thrown out of both state and federal court. The attorneys argue that Unalaska police didn't have probable cause to conduct searches back in May. That's when police said they traced a heroin sale to Nguyen's store. Officers had asked a criminal informant to help them buy drugs in the community. The informant reached out to a man named Eric Roach, who allegedly paid a visit to the Dutch Harbor Asia store. After that, Roach allegedly gave two packets of heroin to the police informant. That's when officers swooped in. They seized the store and detained Tam Nguyen while they waited for a magistrate to approve their first warrant. In a motion filed in state court in August, David Mallett argued that, quote, the police did not exert any of the standard control over any suspected drug buy between Roach and the defendant. Mallett alleged that the police did not search the suspected buyer to see if he was carrying drugs before he went into the store. On top of that, Mallett wrote, there's no recording of the alleged sale and no concrete proof that his client sold drugs. Without that, Mallett argues, there's no justification for a search warrant. The attorney defending Tam Nguyen in federal court has made similar arguments. The Unalaska Police Department isn't commenting on the case until it's resolved, says Deputy Chief Mike Holman. A federal judge is scheduled to review the request to dismiss evidence in January. In the meantime, Tam Nguyen will stay in jail, but his partner doesn't have to. Now that the state's case is closed, Tu McConnell has been released from custody. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
A team of veterinarians brought spaying, neutering, and vaccinations to two YK Delta villages recently. Alaska Native Rural Veterinary, a Fairbanks-based nonprofit, visited Tuntutuliak and Kinkiganak for a free clinic. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
Veterinarian Paula Gibson is giving a shot to her first patient of the day, a small mixed breed named Roxy.
It'll be easier if you go sleep.
Yeah.
Back in there for a little bit.
Come here.
That is just a sedative. It helps calm them down a little bit, so when we put the IV injection in, they're not quite as wiggly. Okay.
Gibson is in Kongeganek to spay, neuter, vaccinate, and deworm as many dogs as she can in a marathon day. She lives in Missouri, but grew up on ADAC. She's volunteering with Alaska Native Rural Veterinary. This December morning, her mobile surgical unit is set up in a wide hallway at the community laundromat with a window overlooking the ocean. In modern times, rural Western Alaska villages have struggled with loose dog populations. It's not uncommon in some villages to pay young people a bounty of $10 or $20 per dog when things get out of control. Health experts say overpopulation creates the potential for hungry and aggressive dogs and can lead to bites and, in some cases, maulings. The Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation Office of Environmental Health cites 703 documented animal bites in the YK Delta over a seven-year period. In the lobby with about 10 others was Leanne Miller and her small, gold-coated scarlet, age 2. She knew something was up.
I don't know how she feels. Maybe she's excited and scared and nervous at the same time.
The community of over 400, located west of the mouth of the Kuskokwim, a few miles from the coast, doesn't get visits from vets. Residents would need to fly to Bethel, which becomes cost prohibitive for many. The result can be an overpopulation of stray and loose dogs, raising the risk for dog bites, contact with rabies, and more hungry dogs getting into garbage. Jonathan Otto of VPSO brought his German wire-haired pointer hunting dog, Nuka, in to be neutered. Sergeant Otto says spaying and neutering is a better alternative to how village dog populations are usually controlled.
They call me and we find somebody to do the dog control. Mm-hmm. They round them up and bring them to the dump and take care of them.
Joe Joseph is president of the Kangiganak Tribal Council, which hosted the clinic in their building. He says the village dog control efforts are only a temporary fix.
But this one that they have right now, neutering dogs, fixing them up, it's going to help us a lot. And I'm glad they're doing that. For the safety of our kids, for the safety of our elders.
And it's not just dogs they're taking care of.
We call him Kitty and sometimes Bobby.
Hannah Jimmy held the gray cat, thought to be one of three in town. But after Gibson was finished with Bobby, there will be no Bobby Juniors. By late morning, the line was long for pet owners, and Gibson was eager to have as many animals as she could come across her table. Gibson, who also works with Christian Veterinary Mission, says every dog counts.
It may sound like we're not doing enough when you look at the actual numbers of animals, but then when you break it down into how many puppies one dog can have or one male dog can father, we're at least stopping that much.
Angie Fitch is director for Alaska Native Rural Veterinary.
One female could have, 16 to 20 puppies a year.
The team sterilized 38 dogs during their visit to two communities, which in a few months can expect fewer puppy litters and hopefully fewer problem dogs. Sponsors of the clinic include Grant Aviation, Delta Western, and the YKHC Office of Environmental Health. In Kangiganak, I'm Ben Matheson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shady Grove Oliver and Homer, Matthew Smith and Nome, Jay Barrett and Kodiak, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, and Ben Matheson in Kangiganak. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki, Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $10 million to nonprofit organizations benefiting everything from Alaska's youth to the arts to healthcare. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive and well in Alaska. So come on, Alaska, warm your heart by sharing your PFD. Pick, click, give. This message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.